this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
My name is Mumia Abu-Jamal. I'm a journalist, a husband, a father, a grandfather, and an African-American.
December 9th marks the 43rd anniversary of the unjust incarceration of political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal.
His only crime that they accuse him mad of is that he survived. He survived a murder attempt.
We'll hear from Jamal Ibn Mumia, the son of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
We began to understand that the leaders of that movement tended to be gay men and lesbian women. And they were doing some real hellified organizing about the matter of black life under the threat of police terror.
For the first time after 43 years of confinement, Mumia has spoken out about LGBTQ issues.
It's difficult to describe and explain on both an intellectual and emotional level to know that this man has produced this much work in that kind of space.
And Dr. Todd Stephen Burroughs on the new exhibition, Mumia Abu-Jamal, A Portrait of Mass Incarceration at Brown University. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akul Holt.
My name is Mumia Abu-Jamal. I'm a journalist, a husband, a father, a grandfather, and an African-American. I live in the fastest-growing public housing tract in America. In 1981, I was a reporter for WUHY and president of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists. Currently, I'm a writer and a public radio commentator.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal introducing himself as a radio commentator in prison in 1992. Mumia is currently held in Mahoney State Correctional Institution in eastern Pennsylvania, where he continues to practice journalism. He's the author of 13 books and thousands of broadcast essays. While in prison, Mumia has earned his bachelor's and master's degrees and is now working on his PhD dissertation. We'll now hear a clip from Manufacturing Guilt, a short film about Mumia Abu-Jamal's case. Produced in 2013 by Stephen, Victoria, and Noel Hanaran for Street Legal Cinema and Prison Radio. The film summarizes just a few of the injustices committed against Mumia during his murder trial. The first voice you'll hear is that of former Philadelphia reporter and current Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez, followed by film producer Stephen Victoria.
People really don't understand what the climate was in Philadelphia in the years before Mumia was arrested. Because if they did, they would look at his arrest and his trial in a different fashion.
In 1982, Philadelphia journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal was convicted of first-degree murder in the killing of police officer Daniel Faulkner. On the July 4th weekend, he was sentenced to death. In 2001, federal court judge William Yon overturned Abu-Jamal's death sentence as illegally imposed and unconstitutional. Yet Abu-Jamal remained on death row for more than 10 years while the Philadelphia district attorney continued to pursue his execution. In 2011, the DA's office conceded defeat, and after 30 years on death row, Abu-Jamal was transferred from solitary confinement and joined the general prison population, where he continues his appeals. Mumia Abu-Jamal has said numerous times, "My only crime that night is that I survived." In fact, the effort to legally execute Abu-Jamal has only recently ended, but the first attempt to kill him may have been made on that fateful night of December 9, 1981. Abu-Jamal was also critically wounded, shot through the chest, and found near the prone body of Daniel Faulkner. And the evidence that convicted him for the murder, well, it doesn't exist. It's been well established over the years that Abu-Jamal's trial was patently unjust. For instance, the Philadelphia DA trained prosecutors to exclude blacks from juries. In Abu-Jamal's case, 11 out of the 15 peremptory strikes were made to bar blacks from his jury. What this short film will document is how countless due process violations began just moments after the shooting of Daniel Faulkner and Mumia Abu-Jamal, when members of the Philadelphia Police Department began to manufacture Abu-Jamal's guilt and, perhaps more importantly, conceal his innocence. In the culture wars that have punted Mumia the effigy back and forth across ideological fields of politics, race, and class, the attempt has been made to diminish the relevance of Abu Jamal as a journalist in 1981. But this man, who was elected president of the Philadelphia chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists, was already well known throughout the city as a fiercely independent up-and-coming journalist. In fact, by the age of 15, the FBI was tracking the young writer for the Black Panther Party through their draconian and illegal program known as COINTELPRO. Not for violent behavior, but because of his, quote, inclination to appear and speak at public gatherings. Also, in 1981, he was well known to the Philadelphia Police Department as an outspoken journalist who reported on police corruption and brutality, in particular with regard to the Philly PD's hostile relationship with the controversial MOVE organization, culminating in a year-long police siege of the MOVE house that ended in 1978 with the shooting death of police officer James Ramp. 9 members of MOVE were charged with the murder, and during his coverage of the trial, Abu Jamal strongly criticized the actions of the police and the prosecution, including the implication that the officer was most likely killed by police crossfire. The MOVE trial concluded just a year and a half before Abu Jamal and Faulkner were found shot on that fateful night. And it was only 4 months from the federal trial of MOVE leader John Africa, whose acquittal on gun charges left the police and DA's office infuriated.
When they saw who they had, this was number one. I mean, wow, you know, look what we done ran into. We got a panther, and we're going to kill this panther. We're going to kill this here, right here.
That was a clip from the 2013 film Manufacturing Guilt, a short film about Mumia Abu-Jamal's case. Next, we have a legal update on Mumia's case recorded for WBEI's Out FM radio show by Dr. Johanna Fernandez, co-founder of the campaign to bring Mumia home.
This is a legal update in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. The latest development in Mumia's case happened just this past September 10th, 2024, when the Superior Court of Pennsylvania denied Mumia Abu-Jamal's appeal. The appeal sought an evidentiary hearing on newly discovered evidence, which a lower court refused to grant. His lawyers will now appeal the decision of the Superior Court of Pennsylvania to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. You're probably wondering, what exactly is this new evidence, and why do the courts keep refusing to examine the meaning and significance of the new evidence in a proper evidentiary hearing? Well, the new evidence surfaced almost 6 years ago, back in December 2018. It had been concealed for 35 years and was found in 6 boxes that were tucked away in a remote corner of the Philadelphia DA's office. So what exactly was in those 6 boxes? Well, one of the standout finds was a letter from 1982 penned by Robert Chobert, the original prosecutor's star witness, who was a Philadelphia cab driver who testified against Mumia. This letter was written right after Mumia's conviction trial. And in it, Chobert asks prosecutor Joe McGill about money he was owed. Sounds sketchy, right? Well, that's because it is. The letter strongly suggests that Chobert's testimony may have been bribed and that he had a personal stake in pleasing the prosecutor, who promised him something in return for his testimony. This is a classic case of prosecutorial misconduct, also known as a Brady violation. So how do we know it's a Brady violation? Well, witnesses sometimes incur legitimate expenses during a trial when they're testifying against a defendant. But that wasn't the case with Chobert. In fact, during a 1995 hearing, Robert Chobert himself testified that he was a kept witness during the Abu Jamal trial. He was put up in a hotel, fed daily, and chauffeured to and from work by the police before and after the trial when he was testifying against Mumia. So why would the prosecutor need to pay him more, or anything for that matter, after the trial? Well, that's exactly the kind of question that could be explored if the courts allowed an evidentiary hearing. Mumia's attorneys filed another claim based on the evidence that came to light in 2018. Among the documents found in those boxes were notes taken by Joe McGill, the original prosecutor in the case. And in these notes, McGill tracked the race of potential jurors by marking a B for black or a W for white. The notes also reveal that McGill, the prosecutor, excluded black jurors who were employed, but allowed white jurors who were unemployed to stay on the jury. Clearly, he was trying to shape the jury based on racial assumptions and racial stereotypes, which is unconstitutional. This kind of violation is known as a Batson claim, named after the landmark Supreme Court case that ruled racial discrimination in jury selection unconstitutional. In any other case, this evidence would likely have led to a new trial or even to a vacated conviction, setting the defendant free. Mumia's lawyers have filed appeals based on the ruling of Judge Lucretia Clemens of the Philadelphia Court of Common Pleas. She was the first judge to hear the claims surrounding this new evidence. But like most of the judges who have heard Mumia's case over the years, Judge Clemens willingly twisted the law to uphold the Mumia exception. The Mumia exception is the fact that normal legal standards are ignored or bent in Mumia Abu-Jamal's case due to political pressure, particularly from the Fraternal Order of Police and the Pennsylvania political establishment, to maintain Mumia's conviction at all cost. Clemens dismissed the Brady violation, claiming that even if Chobert was bribed, it wouldn't have changed the case's outcome. But that's a stretch, given that Chobert was the prosecution's key witness. As for the Batson claim, Clemens denied the Batson claim without a hearing, saying it wasn't filed on time, ignoring the fact that Mumia's attorneys couldn't have raised the issues they raised earlier because the evidence was hidden for 35 years. So what's the bottom line? The courts need public pressure to do the right thing. Just like when advocates of Mumia hit the streets to get him the Hep C medication he needed to survive. And let's not forget that Mumia only got off death row because of the pressure mounted by a boisterous international movement. Only a similar wave of public outcry will bring about justice this time around and set Mumia free.
That was Dr. Johanna Fernandez, co-founder of the campaign to bring Mumia home. We thank Bob Lederer of WBAI's Out FM for sharing the recordings we just heard.
If the corporate media's job is to sell fear, conflict, and ignorance, yours is to show courage amidst adversity, cooperation, community, complexity, and the sheer genius and brilliance that exists in all of humanity. People have to be able to see and sense a better way forward.
You can light me down, but I will never be your prisoner. Victims are the ones that just obey and just give it up. Even in this world, we enslave like some prisoners. A freedom fighter fights till the world is enough. You can light me down, but I will never be your prisoner. Victims are the ones that just obey and just give it up. Even in this world, we enslave like some prisoners. A freedom fighter fights till the world is enough. Police terrorism, television showing fiction. Officers shot, them attorneys want convictions. Silence in the movements that stood up for liberation. Scared of self-defense and people's self-determination. Terrified witnesses, forced cooperation. 30 long years behind the walls of these racists. Hero to the youth and everyone for revolution. We need a million Mumias on the streets as a solution. Take over the media, tell the story.
Never a Prisoner, Free Mumia by Rebel Diaz. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Next, J.R. Bell Ray of Block Report Radio spoke to Jamal Ibn Mumia, the son of political prisoner and prolific journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal, about his father being held captive for 43 years.
Can you talk about his incarceration? When do you remember hearing about it? And how did it affect you growing up?
Okay, so my mother had took the TVs out the house, and we couldn't look at no newspapers because we were still obviously young in grade school. And one of the things that happened is my father's, when he went on death row, he could not touch him or nothing. So he couldn't have physical contact with his children for at least over 30 years. So now just think about a person, family oriented, very touchy, very, you know, outgoing. And one of the things that it done is it made us to our family very confused. You got your father there, that big gap come in, and he's vacuumed out. So now your mother is trying to do two jobs. She's trying to survive. She's trying to do what she can. And, of course, I'm from the inner city. I became a product of the inner city at a young age, getting involved in all types of juvenile things, which have led me with a history into jail at a young age, just trying to survive and help my mother and help my family. And my father has been taken away, and he's on death row. So we just try to just survive the best way we can. And I just started speaking out about that because I think that people don't really understand how black men have been targeted, black and brown, in the communities. And we're talking about the 80s and 70s and the 90s. You know, mostly all type of good, positive role models have been taken. So now he's away. There's no physical contact. I'm trying to be out here and assist things with my mother and trying to make things right. I got in trouble. I'm trying to figure out life. And it was just very hard. It was very hard without a father there, physically.
Has your father's case ever had an impact on your cases legally?
Yes. So there has been some lawfare and targeting. Once I started reaching out, when I heard that my father, once he had told us, like, look, they're going to sign my death warrant, you know, and I was like, what? It was just a reality because we try to block out things of trauma, you know. And one of the things I started doing is speaking out. And when I started speaking out, I didn't know that the same powers that be was observing me speaking out for my father, and they targeted me. They took me to a place where they weaponized the charges and trumped up the charges from a state charge and took me straight out the state courtroom and transferred it into a federal charge with a secret seal indictment and all this type of crazy stuff where they had me looking at a life sentence, you know, and one of their things was like, you can plead out to 25 years, you can do this and that. I'm 23 years old. You know, I don't know nothing about no serious crimes or nothing of that, but they had lawfare and abused their powers and transferred these things to punish my father. And it gave me a reality check that your voice means nothing if you're targeted by a corrupt establishment that abused their authorities and their power. And one of the things that they did with me is put me away about 15 years in the feds for a charge of having a firearm without a license turned to a convicted felon from the juvenile records. They used them to a person that they can just label. Because the whole thing is they play with word semantics. They put words out. There was no commission of a crime. There was no victim. There was nothing. They just saying that you had possession, we can put you away. I went to trial, blue trial and everything. And they was like, well, that's Lil Mumia. We got him out the way.
Well, that brings us to another situation on how they treat your father legally. Can you talk a little bit about the Mumia exceptions, the Mumia rules?
Yes. So one of the things that they have mastered in the Pennsylvania system is that whenever they deny my father from any type of legal access or any type of legal relief, they put it under a Mumia rule. And they have been using this on other inmates to create animosity within the institution to my father. For example, when people are going up against their case and they fighting and they like, look, you know what? We're just going to say that's the same thing that we had with the Mumia rule. So we're going to use that to deny it. It's pretty much like how they do the habeas corpus 2255 and the 2254, where they say that this got to be the gatekeeper. It got to go through this and go through this. So they created this. And it's like so magical. Even with my father's case, even after 40-something years, they found boxes of evidence that the prosecution had in their possession for over 30 years that they have not shared with nobody, and even had payouts and bribes and everything from judges' notes. And it was just so much corruption that they still use the Mumia rule as an exception. And it's only because his only crime that they accused him mad of is that he survived. He survived a murder attempt. And this is one of the things that we have to understand, that this system does look and target people of our strength, people that gets out. And like I said, my father and my mother was Francine, and they were young. You know, they went to school together in college, and they were Panthers. They constantly educated. They pushed self-learn on me. They pushed self-teach on me. They pushed self-defense on me. All of the criteria that the Black Panther Party was originally given to the people, my family has put that on me as being a Panther Cub. So I know that there is a system at some point that don't want that structure for the Black family, Black and brown. So one of the things is that they take it to the courthouse, and then once they get you into the courthouse, they just start to use these things like the Mumia rule, the exception. And they just working my dad from both sides, denying his cases and turning inmates that he's in, you know, incarcerated with against him.
When you say they're turning inmates against them, what you talking about?
Well, I knew some people during my incarceration in the sabbatical, which is the prison. They said, your pop case messed my case up. They using your pop case to deny my case and give me a life sentence. You know, because people that don't have the resources, they're going to fall victim to the gatekeeper. See, so when I say that is, he's not that I know of any physical threat, but it was a tactic that they were using.
Hmm.
So now you got people in there with life sentences or whatever, and they might have seen a little relief, and they say, okay, we're going to use the Mumia rule on this. And they're like, hold on, wait a minute. I got on my jury trial, you know, a juror did this or a juror did this, and it was wrong. And they'll say, oh, well, we're going to use the Mumia rule because his juror did something similar like that. And judge, we already went through this. We don't have to waste the court's time or their money and all of that. And they deny them people's appeals.
Would you call this a form of the counterintelligence program? A lot of people believe, and the FBI claim, that the counterintelligence program, which was used to destroy Black organizations, Black political organizations in the United States, from Marcus Garvey to the Black Panther Party. Would you say that this is a continuation of that same program?
Let's get to it. It was birthed by J. Edgar Hoover. Once people can really go through cases. Now, don't get me wrong. There's people that's wrong and there's people that's right. But when you got lawfare, meaning people are weaponizing the court system, weaponizing the penalty phase, the prosecution has been compromised so they can word it and play with it any way that they want. That's how my dad, how could you come off a death row and they gave the prosecution an option again? You got 120 days before you, if you don't do anything, we're going to commute it to life. What? After 30 years? And now he go from death row to life. How is this even possible in law? You see what I'm saying?
Right.
So if it's a constitutional thing, I don't think a lot of people understand when you got a capital case, okay, the same jury is the same jury, meaning you got the same jury that you had to found you guilty is the same jury that do your sentencing, okay? Mm-hmm. In regular cases, you got the jury to find you guilty, and then the jury leave, and then the judge do your sentence. Okay? Mm-hmm. But you got a capital case, so when you got a constitutional violation with one of those jurors, it don't matter what process was it in, the beginning or the end part. The whole case is tanked.
That was Jamal Ibn Mumia speaking to J.R. Val Ray of Block Report Radio.
Now put your hands up, people, put your hands up. Come on, put your hands up, people, put your hands up. Yeah, put your hands up, people, put your hands up. Now put your hands up, people, put your hands up. Take it. Now put your soul up. Put your soul up.
Arrested Development, Unity. Attorney Nkechi Taifa, veteran host and producer of WPFW's Human Rights and Justice, spoke to Dr. Todd Stephen Burroughs, editor of The Trials of Mumia Abu-Jamal, a biography in 25 voices, about an exhibition, Mumia Abu-Jamal, a Portrait of Mass Incarceration at Brown University. The exhibition includes a vast set of Mumia's records, writings, and artwork.
My understanding, this symposium, this conference, using Mumia's Abu-Jamal as the backdrop, was really a spotlight and focus on issues dealing with mass incarceration and the impact of the American carceral system on millions of lives. And one of the things I saw that I'd like you to share, because you saw it in person, was a facsimile of the solitary confinement prison cell that Mumia Abu-Jamal occupied. Can you tell us about that? And what was that like, viewing that facsimile of the prison cell?
From the beginning, the activists who have been trying to free Mumia Abu-Jamal had said that his death row cell was the size of a bathroom. And what Brown did was they recreated that cell. And the only thing that they added that wasn't in the original cell was a window. Mm-hmm. Because they wanted us to be able to see into the cell and to see what Mumia would have on his table and what he would have around his bed and all this. So I really haven't recovered from it. I'll describe it this way. It is the size of a bathroom.
Excuse me. You need to say a small bathroom.
It is the size of an average bathroom, not an Nkechi Taifa bathroom, okay? Something like that. I live in Newark, New Jersey, like that kind of bathroom, all right? But seriously, again, it's difficult to describe and explain on both an intellectual and emotional level to know that this man has produced this much work in that kind of space. You see his glasses, you see his typewriter when he was allowed to use it. But I mean, he really wasn't allowed to use a typewriter or a typing machine or whatever you want to call it for so many years on death row. So he had to do so many things by hand, all his articles, all his early books, even his master's thesis, which he had to do two copies of. And of course, the Pennsylvania prison authorities would not let him use a photocopy machine. So he had to write his master's thesis in pencil or in pen with the inside of the pen, because, you know, they said the outside of the pen would be a weapon. He had to use the inside of a pen or pencil to write his master's dissertation twice. Now, I want you to think about that. When we talk about struggle, this man is by himself 23 hours a day in terms of death row. And this is the cell we were seeing.
Boxes of legal documents.
Boxes of legal documents. I haven't gotten to the whole glass case that contains all of his degrees and certifications. We haven't even discussed that yet, right? Yeah. So I'm just saying that first you see the stuff that's on his table, like white out and things like that. And then you see, because he's using, because they told him that, certain things were quote unquote dangerous to have in the cell, right? You know, like a typewriter or something like that. But it wasn't dangerous to have a television in the cell with a glass window, right? So you can literally see the harassment, because you're sitting here going, how could somebody write 10, 12 books and 1,000 articles and all of this in this spell? You can't even comprehend it, right? And then do legal work and all of this other kind of stuff. You see the cot surrounded by boxes, you see the table, and then you see the sink, which is right above the toilet, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is how this man lived for 20-something years until he got in general population around 2011. This is how he lived from basically 1982, 1983 to 2011. And he produced all of this work from that space.
Mm-mm-mm. That was WPFW's veteran host and producer, attorney Nkechi Taifa of Human Rights and Justice, and Dr. Todd Stephen Burroughs, editor of The Trials of Mumia Abu-Jamal, a biography and 25 voices, discussing a new exhibition, Mumia Abu-Jamal, a Portrait of Mass Incarceration. The exhibition features a rare collection of papers and materials at an Ivy League institution, seeking a continued conversation about the impact of the American carceral system on millions of lives, including the family and friends of those who have spent time in prison and jails. Visit brown.edu for more information.
American carelessness.
My name is Asada Shakur.
We have been subjected to the dehumanizing power of exploitation and racism for hundreds of years.
Based on their false accusations against me, any police officer could shoot me on sight. National and local police agencies created the situation.
And in spite of the fact that they were completely suppressed in a physical sense, their demeanor when they entered the courtroom, that they were not for a moment going to resign themselves to that situation.
Only reflect that the racist attitude of the general power structure, and I haven't seen a fair trial.
American.
This kind of thing has to not only be exposed, but has to be answered.
And in order to achieve, they have to be twice as good as white.
That was music by Terry Lynn Carrington, Social Science, No Justice for Political Prisoners, featuring Michelle Indegocello. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. We'll now hear from Bob Lederer, co-host of Alt FM on Pacifica Radio WBAI in New York.
In a recent phone interview with me, Mumia Abu-Jamal explained, for the first time publicly in 43 years of imprisonment, his decades-long evolution and that of other former members of the Black Panther Party to open solidarity with queer and trans liberation. He also talked about the key role played by women of the party.
Brother Mumia, thanks so much for agreeing to this interview for Alt FM. It's an honor to have this opportunity to speak with you, as you are a brilliant and empathic revolutionary analyst and a role model for progressive journalists and for all people working for peace and justice.
So, Brother Mumia, I want to turn now to your evolving views over the decades on the role of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people in U.S. society. You have indeed shown a remarkable evolution, as have many in the overall society, in parallel with the growing organizing and strength of the diverse LGBTQ plus movements demanding our human rights. In 1970, at age 16, Mumia was Lieutenant of Information of the Philadelphia chapter of the Black Panther Party. In the 2012 book, The Classroom and the Cell, Conversations on Black Life in America, a dialogue between Mumia and Black liberation scholar Mark Lamont Hill, Mumia said, quote, "Huey P. Newton spoke out back in 1970 about gay liberation. He didn't just mention it. He said, we, the Black Panther Party, support gay liberation just as we support women's liberation. He saw it as part of the struggle for human liberation. It was the most forward position of any radical and revolutionary movement of the period," unquote. So as you look back at your July 1970 statement in the Black Panther calling racist Philadelphia police officials, quote, faggots, unquote, who engaged in, quote, perversion, unquote, and then look at Huey Newton's August 1970 letter just a month later supporting the women's liberation and gay liberation movements, can you tell us more about your viewpoint at that time when you were 16, and more about how other straight men as well as women in the party viewed the letter and what impact it had?
Well, if you're talking about my letter, I actually don't have a memory of it because this is like my 70th year of life. You're talking about my 16th year of life.
Right.
But when I read your note referring to that, my mind actually flashed to the Minister of Information at that time, Eldridge Cleaver, who wrote and spoke in similar ways. And as the Lieutenant of Information of the Philadelphia branch and later at the National Office's newspaper, as someone working on the paper, I adored Eldridge. He was very influential in my thinking. And so I was probably consciously imitating Eldridge and imitating his speech. When you think about what Huey said at the Revolutionary People's Constitutional Convention about gay folks and lesbian and queer folk, I must be honest with you, it was not well received by members of the party. We were shocked in some ways, confused in other ways. But as usual, this was Huey at his finest. And he was a true revolutionary intellectual who was usually ahead of his peers. And there were, let's be honest, there were few peers of Huey P. Newton, which is a good thing and a bad thing in a way. But what Huey was beginning to understand, I think, especially coming from his prison experience, is that any revolution, any real struggle in the bastion of the empire had to really involve all kinds of people in that struggle to be successful. Now, to understand that intellectually is one thing, but to understand it empathically, right, is another.
In 1970, the time Mumia is discussing, Eldridge Cleaver was the Black Panther Minister of Communications and leader of the party's international office in Algeria. He became famous for his book, Soul on Ice, describing his evolution from rapist to revolutionary, citing the key teachings of Malcolm X and his insightful analysis of the racist history of the United States. The book also included such homophobic and sexist statements as, quote, homosexuality is a sickness, just as are baby rape or wanting to become the head of General Motors, unquote, as well as accusing James Baldwin of having a, quote, racial death wish to become a white man in a black body, unquote. And finally, this statement, quote, if a lesbian is anything, she is a frigid woman, a frozen C word, though he wrote it out, unquote. Cleaver later went on to become a public spokesperson for right-wing evangelical Christianity. In Mumia's book, We Want Freedom, A Life in the Black Panther Party, he wrote that, quote, much of the movement was deeply macho in orientation and treated women in many of these groups in a distinctly secondary and disrespectful fashion, unquote. But he also noted that, quote, women were far more than mere appendages of male ego and power. They were valued and respected comrades, unquote. I asked Mumia about two women Panther leaders, Afeni Shakur and Erica Huggins. Afeni was one of the Panther 21, key members of the New York Black Panther Party, indicted on false federal conspiracy charges under the FBI's COINTELPRO program aimed at destroying left and particularly black liberation organizations. The 21 faced 186 counts of attempted arson, attempted murder, and conspiracy to blow up various buildings. After the state's longest trial and just 1 hour of deliberation, a jury acquitted them of all charges. Similarly, Erica Huggins was key in defeating frame-up murder conspiracy charges in New Haven against herself, Black Panther leader Bobby Seale, and others, for which she spent 2 years in pretrial detention just after the FBI instigated assassination of her Panther husband, John Huggins, and Bunchy Carter. Brother Mumia, I want to ask you about your conclusions about the roles of both women and sexism in the Black Panther Party and the broader Black liberation movement.
Well, the women really were the glory of the party. And I mean, they were the party's hardest workers, the most disciplined members and leaders. And, you know, a lot of times when a brother would go around the quarter and even though it's against orders, he would smoke a joint or have a drink. The sisters were there early every morning to open the office or to open the breakfast program and make sure that the people got served first. They were the first to open and the last to leave. And, you know, you talk about Afeni Shakur. I quoted from her closing argument to the jury in the Panther 21 trial. It's difficult, even all of these years later, for me to read that without weeping, right? Because she was brilliant. She was the best lawyer in the courtroom because she understood how to talk to people and to reach them and to, you know, unwrap their fear and to open their hearts. And that was hard work back then. She did it effortlessly. She was brilliant. And, you know, Erica, think about, like, most people knew of Erica by reading her poems, right? Her poems just touched the heart and moved people in ways that, you know, a hard, didactic, analytical, theoretical article could not. She knew how to reach people, right? And especially with, you know, the tragedy of the loss of her husband, John.
In 1991, I was part of a New York group of white activists called Queers United in Support of Political Prisoners, or QUISP, that organized an event to educate and mobilize the queer community to write letters opposing Mumia's execution. We wrote to Mumia to see if he was okay with this. He wrote back that he appreciated and encouraged our event, but needed to inform us that, quote, as a move person, we see heterosexual hookups as natural and inherently right, unquote. He also wrote that he hoped we didn't feel disrespected.
We went ahead with the event, urging the community to fight Mumia's unjust conviction and death sentence. This started a long-term dialogue with Mumia by LGBTQ activists nationwide that played a role in his later evolution. Our keynote speaker at that 1991 QISP event was Daruba Bin Wahat, the former Black Panther and member of the clandestine Black Liberation Army, fresh from his release after 19 years of FBI-orchestrated false imprisonment. Daruba, a heterosexual Black Muslim, gave an amazing speech, replayed on several Pacifica radio stations, calling for the lesbian gay movement to support the freedom of Mumia and all U.S. political prisoners. Daruba included these powerful observations and credited his raised consciousness on sexism and homophobia to his then-partner, Tanikhil Jones.
As a Black revolutionary who has struggled and continues to struggle in the cause of Black liberation, I cannot but conclude that if we are to be successful, we have to deal with sexism head on. It is not something that can be swept under the rug. It is not something that we can postpone till tomorrow pending revolutionary victory. After a long and arduous struggle with Tanikhil, I could not but conclude that the issue of misogyny and the issue of homophobia are very much interwoven. So therefore, it is impossible to struggle against sexism vis-a-vis Black women or white women or in the overall society at large without simultaneously struggling against homophobia. This is very important, and I find myself constantly struggling with brothers in the Black movement in this respect.
Later, you will hear Mumia refer back to Daruba's support for lesbian and gay liberation. Now, returning to the interview with Mumia.
Can you reflect back on your views? Now I'm asking you about 33 years ago, in 1991, when you told QISP, Queers United in Support of Political Prisoners, about your belief that, quote, heterosexual hookups, unquote, were the only natural ones.
When I was writing to QISP, I was writing from the perspective of a MOVE supporter and someone who was following the teachings of John Africa and really what was a naturalist revolutionary movement as opposed to a nationalist. But what we learn, right, when we study revolution is what? That all things change. And that means perceptions, it means perspectives, it means even vision. Like, you know, we see and experience things differently. One of the last statements of Delbert Africa, one of the elder brothers of the movement, one of the really clearest thinkers, best speakers, and best known of MOVE people. And he made a clarion call to LGBT people. It surprised me to read that. But he was doing that in the context of what? The Black Lives Matter movement that was surging, right, several years ago. We began to understand that the leaders of that movement tended to be gay men and lesbian women. And they were doing some real hellified organizing about the matter of Black life under the threat of police terror. And we hadn't seen any kind of organizing like that in years, in decades. So you give credit where credit is due, and they were due, and they continue to be due, tremendous credit for their organizing around the simple principle of Black life. And it took courage.
And finally, can you share any observations or conversations you've had over your 42 years in prison with gay men or trans women that have nourished your understanding as to what they're subjected to and their overall situation in prison?
Well, you know, being in many ways a blockhead and a nerd, I used to think that for a gay or even a trans man in prison would be a touch of heaven. It's quite the reverse. They catch hell from prisoner and staff alike. So think about the alienation and isolation that breeds in such a person. I've seen people, literally seen them, try to commit suicide by jumping off of a rail onto the floor. If you hit your head or your neck, you can kill yourself. And I've seen that several times in several places in several prisons. Prison, by its nature, breeds isolation in human beings and atomizes them to the extent that it further isolates and separates them. And for trans and gay men in prison, it's a hell in a hell, you know. They get the worst of it. It's not a good place. It can never be a good place. It's not designed to be a good place. And everything about it really works to the destruction of human and social relationships. And I thought about it in the same context as Daruba Bin Wahed, who was one of the Panther 21, right? And he talked about gay liberation. And so I think some of the most advanced sectors of the Black Freedom Movement began to think about it far more broadly and far more deeply than even when Huey made his call.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal in conversation with WBAI producer and host Bob Lederer. To hear more, visit outfm.org. Here is a recent commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal, recorded and produced by Prison Radio.
The end of empire? For years, I've studied the histories of empires, especially their rise and their fall. Europe's most illustrious example, Rome, grew from a city to a state and finally a world empire. When their men tired of fighting, they trained non-Romans in their war tactics. And when they were treated with contempt by Romans, they responded by sacking the city and stealing their treasure before leaving. It wasn't the end of Rome, but it was a signal of the beginning of the end. Empires rise and empires fall. That is a lesson of history. A century ago, Britain boasted that the sun would never set on the British Empire. A few world wars later, and after decolonization struggles, and it is an empire no more. This recent Brexit episode has cleaved its economic strength. And most foreign observers see it as a self-inflicted wound. It shows us that great empires can succumb to a kind of suicide. Now, what of the American empire? Is it immune to the lessons of history? Half a century ago, it lost a war to a poor Asian nation. After, it inflicted millions of casualties upon them. The country that won the war was called Vietnam. Just days ago, it elected an immoral man whose only real claim to fame was his bank account. Because of this election, America has no voice with which to tell other countries how to elect their leaders. It has no voice in questions of morality. It has great power, yes, but that didn't win in Vietnam, nor in Afghanistan, where they simply outweighed the Americans. Empires are not immortal. They may last for centuries, yes, but ultimately they rise and they fall. With love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
That commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal, The End of an Empire, was recorded on November 18, 2024, and produced by Prison Radio. Mumia Abu-Jamal is a journalist, humanitarian abolitionist, and author of 13 books and thousands of broadcast essays. Visit prisonradio.org to learn more about Mumia Abu-Jamal and other political prisoners in the U.S. Mumia's case is plagued with illegal interference by the government, and we must do all we can to return him to his family and community. You can write and call officials of the Pennsylvania prison system demanding that Mumia, who had open-heart surgery, 3 years ago, be given his prescribed diet and exercise, as should all prisoners. You can also request that Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro grant clemency to 70-year-old Mumia and all elderly political prisoners in the state. For contact information and more details, visit bringmumiahome.com and freemumia.com. Free Mumia now. Those were voices from a Free Mumia protest held in Houston, Texas on December 7, 2024 by the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement.
Wake up everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more backwards thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There is so much hatred, war and poverty. Wake up all you teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. 'Cause they're the ones who's coming up and the world is in their hands. So when you teach the children, teach them the very best you can.
Houston's own Toby Nwegwe, Wake Up Everybody, originally by Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. Next, we have an update on the case of the Uhuru 3, Pacifica's Paulina Basilia reports.
On Monday, December 16th, the Uhuru 3, 83-year-old Chairman O'Malley Eschetella, Penny Hess, and Jesse Neville will go before Judge William Jung in federal court in Tampa for sentencing. The government wants to put them in prison for 5 years and fine them $250,000 on a conspiracy conviction resulting from their exercise of their First Amendment rights to freedom of speech and association. The government charged that the group's opposition to U.S. funding of war in Ukraine, petitioning the U.N. to stop U.S. genocide of African people, and running local candidates on a reparations platform was expressed under the direction and control of Russia. Over 1,600 character letters have been submitted to the judge asking for not one day in prison. Supporters are mobilizing to pack the court for the sentencing on December 16th, joining PAM Africa of the Free Mumia campaign, organizers with the Free Leonard Peltier Committee, and many others traveling from around the U.S. More information at handsoffuhuru.org.
And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all the Pacifica sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Bob Lederer, attorney Nkechi Taifa, J.R. Bell Ray, Paulina Basilia, and myself, Akua Holt. Special thanks to Noel Hanoran, director of Prison Radio, a multimedia production studio that brings to the public the voices of incarcerated women, men, and children. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening. Before we go, I'll leave you with this quote. Before this generation goes on to its ancestors, we must do our level best to pass on our lessons so that they live in our people's minds and lives. Mumia Abu-Jamal.